You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Pivot. My name is Adif Rafiq, and I'm your host. These are peculiar times for America's Jews. In the wake of the October 7th attacks by Hamas, American Jews are very much at the center of the national political debate here in the United States. The Hamas attacks led to an initial outpouring of support for Israel, and by extension, American Jews. But public opinion, especially on the left, has become far more critical of Israel, as it's taken the lives of over 10,000 Palestinian children and thousands of older civilians. Today, teenage TikTokers argue over whether Zionism is a form of racism, and elite university presidents are on the hot seat for allegedly not doing enough to combat anti-Semitism. The major national debates over cancel culture, race, foreign policy, and DEI have all melded into the broader conversation over what it means to be a Jew in America. And while we're not seeing a return to the quote-unquote Jewish question of pre-war Europe, the discussions these days are in many ways existential. And these debates are most profound within the American Jewish community, as young Jews abandon Zionism and the rift between progressive Jews and the major American Jewish organizations like AIPAC and the ADL widens. But these debates, as my guest Emily Tamkin will explain in our discussion, are inherent to the American Jewish experience. Emily is the author of Bad Jews, A History of American Jewish Politics and Identities, a book that examines the last century of American Jewish politics, culture, identities, and arguments. Her book is an essential guidepost to today's debates on what it means to be a Jew in America. Emily's been a foreign affairs journalist for BuzzFeed, Foreign Policy, and The New Statesman. And she's also the author of a book on George Soros. We're delighted to have her on. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you on, and it was also a pleasure to read your book. I was reading Howard Sacher's 1,500-page history of American Jews just before I started reading yours, and then I took a break from it and got through yours very quickly. It's a very readable survey of the history of American Jews, and I highly recommend it to all our listeners. Now, the reason I brought you on is because I think this is a book that speaks to our moment, the spotlight, the scrutiny from within and from without that many American Jews find themselves in after October 7th. And the book was published in 2022, but you do a great job of outlining the many divides that have now become apparent for a general audience in recent months. But before we get to those divides, I wanted to start with the theme of your book, which is this idea of judgment, how Jews are being judged, not just by those outside the community, but also by fellow Jews. And many people seem to have this notion of what's a good Jew and what's a bad Jew. And so I'm wondering, what's behind this? Why is this judgment so prevalent?
It's interesting. First of all, thank you for that very generous introduction. It's interesting that you say judgment, because I always thought of this as a book about belonging. But of course, these are two sides of the same coin, right? It's a different way of thinking of the same idea.
Right.
I think for certainly the last century of American Jewish history, but really for all of American Jewish history, there's been this question of what does it mean to be Jewish in America, right? What does it mean to be a religious, ethnic, cultural minority in this country? How do you render yourself legible to the broader United States? And how do you render yourself legible to your fellow Jews? How do you get them to, right? Like, how do you get the rest of the country to understand you as a group? And how do you have, how do members of that group understand one another? I don't think this is an experience that has only, I don't think this experience is totally unique to American Jews, but I do think that part of what makes it different for American Jews is that, as I said, being Jewish is, you know, it is a religion, and there have been times in American Jewish history where it's really only been understood as a religious difference, but it's also a set of ethnicities and cultures And that's not something that the United States historically has had great ease understanding, right? The United States understands racial difference really well, unfortunately, and religious difference very well, but ethnicity and culture not so much. And so the question is, well, what is it, you know, if you had one kind of distinctiveness in whatever country you were originally Jewish in, and now a different kind of distinctiveness here, what does that do to your identity? And how can you have a Jewish identity that both allows you to feel distinctive and to feel Jewish, whatever that means to you, and also to feel safe and secure?
And before we get to that question of what it means to be an American Jew and sort of the how that has been answered in a different way over the decades and centuries, I'd like you to first outline who exactly are the Jewish peoples of America, because there's a long history here and we tend to focus on some of the more immediate period, but who are the Jewish peoples of America?
Yeah, I mean, there have been Jews in this country since before it was a country, but originally they were quite small in number, and they were originally Sephardic Jews, which is Jews sort of from Iberian in origin. In the course of the 19th century, this sort of switches, or shortly after the sort of beginning of U.S. Jewish history, it becomes such that Ashkenazi Jews outnumber the Sephardic Jews, Ashkenazi being Jews from Central and Eastern Europe originally. And there's this, you know, in the 19th century, most of the Jews who were here, you know, so they're mostly Ashkenazi and they're mostly from Central Europe and more, let's say, more established, more financially secure, less, let's say, ethnically distinct. There's a great, I mean, I should probably just stick to promoting my own book, but there was a book that came out this year called The Money Kings, which is about these sort of 19th century German Jewish American families who are like captains of finance. And then what happens is that in the late 19th century and early 20th century, economic pressures and also discrimination and violence in Central and Eastern Europe really escalates towards Jewish people. Many come to the United States. And so what you go from having just the small population that's distinctive but can basically present itself as white Americans who pray differently to having a much bigger population, many of whom don't think of themselves as just other white people who pray differently, right? They come from Eastern Europe. They consider themselves ethnically different. They have, you know, they speak Yiddish, not German. They, you know, they have their own Yiddish newspapers. They don't necessarily get along with the Sephardic Jewish immigrants or even think of those Sephardic Jewish immigrants and their descendants as Jewish, right? So from the beginning, we've had this sort of like, what is the paradigmatic Jew? In the 1920s, in sort of an early, you know, I don't want to overstate the political parallels to today, but you basically had conservative politicians, let's say America First politicians, I mean, they call themselves America First, say, these are the wrong kinds of immigrants. They're too, we don't want them assimilating into this country. We don't, they'll only ruin the rest of the country. They're the wrong kind, blah, blah, blah. Quotas are enacted. And this really dramatically cuts down Jewish immigration to the United States. I once had someone ask me, well, did this reverse, you know, in the face of Jewish persecution in Europe leading up to World War II? No, it did not. And in fact, I think it's important to note that anti-Semitism in this country was at an all-time high during World War II while the United States was fighting Nazi Germany. After this period, though, many American Jews are able to be beneficiaries of the GI Bill. Many move out to the suburbs. The United States is at odds with the Soviet Union. And so, you know, this period where American Jews sort of say, okay, you know, we can be out in the suburbs, we can be suburban white people who pray differently again, although they do have this ambivalence toward, okay, but then what makes me distinct, right? If there's sort of romanticization about the days back on the Lower East Side or even back in the old country. And we should say the other thing that's happened around this period is that American Jews have survived during World War II, which many Jews elsewhere in the world, particularly European Jewry, did not. And there's this sense of guilt. There's this sense of we're the ones who were still here. And I think this manifests I think this guilt manifests in a couple of ways, one of which is support of and defense for Israel, particularly after the wars in 67 and especially after 73. And the other way is this tension between, you know, we want to be distinct and we want to feel Jewish, but also we want to keep ourselves safe. So from the mid-20th century, and then, as I said, in the 60s, and especially the 70s, this period of Jewish, I mean, I should say this is all like the sort of rough, you know, I'm speaking in generalizations, but basically over the course of the 20th century, Jewish security, I think in some ways enables Jewish distinctiveness and an embrace of Jewish political issues, including Holocaust remembrance, including, and perhaps most notably, well, including Holocaust remembrance, including a focus on Jewish continuity, that is this idea that like Jews should marry other Jews and have Jewish children, and including support for Israel. That's the story for much of the 20th century. And then in the 21st, I think we start to see how these pillars start to shake. The immigrant story that I just told is one, is sort of, again, the paradigmatic American Jewish immigrant story. But it we should just note that like not every Jewish person in this country is Ashkenazi, though I am. You know, there are also Sephardic Jews. There's Mizrahi Jews who were originally from sort of Middle Eastern area. And also there are Jews whose families did not come over at the early 20th century, who either came over earlier or came over later. And in the book, I talk about, for example, Persian Jews or Jews from the Soviet or ex-Soviet Union who don't relate to the immigrant story and the sort of American Jewish century story that I just told. And what I tried to do in the book is say like, okay, yes, there is this narrative, but this narrative is, while it is true for many people, is that untrue for other Jews?
Yeah, yeah. And I want to unpack that a bit later. But right now, I want to sort of wind the clock back to the late 19th century. Mm-hmm. And we have what seems to be a pretty definitive moment, right? We have these Jews of Germanic origin who maybe pursue what one might call a kind of politics of respectability. These are sort of the uptown American Jews who have progressed materially, live in nice, you know, homes on, let's say, the Upper West Side or something. And then there are all these relatively poor and unlettered people who are coming from Eastern Europe, escaping depredation, escaping bloody violence. And the established community of these German origin Jews have some pretty complicated views of them. Some tend to view these newcomers as more or less uncivilized or undesirable. And so there is a certain perception of what these people need to do to assimilate. So I'd like you to talk about that and then how things change over the next 40 years and this new group assumes a dominant form. Talk to us about that transition that takes place then.
Yeah, I think the relationship between these sort of wealthier, originally German or Central European Jews and their Eastern European later arrival counterparts is a really complicated one, because on the one hand, you know, they helped them. They established charities that were meant to, you know, help them find footing. They helped them learn English. They, you know, sort of looked out for them in some ways. But on the other hand, you have some look into like, well, is there any way that we could just not have them come to New York? Right? Because I think they're, or they had to learn English because if they were running around speaking Yiddish, like these more established Jews did not want Americans more broadly thinking of Jews as like shuttle people, you know, like they had worked very hard to establish themselves in high society. I really think that this speaks to this tension between like, okay, you know, you want to be Jewish and you want to feel proud of that. But also in the late 19th, early 20th century, these richer, more established American Jews did not want anybody, including other Jews, jeopardizing their stability and their security. And one can sort of understand why. Like, look at what was happening in Europe at the time. Look at conversations in Washington saying, maybe we shouldn't think of Jews as white. This is, I didn't say this in my my little introductory spiel, but I do think it's important that while there has been, like, there's a long, rich history of anti-Semitism on a cultural and social level in this country, but legally, for the most part, there has actually not been discrimination against Jews. There are exceptions to this, of course, but most notably under the law for centuries, most American Jews have been considered white. And this is really important, because that comes with certain rights and privileges, including it meant until, you know, the early 1920s when the law was changed such that Jewish immigrants or immigrants from Central Eastern Europe could not come. It meant that you could come here and you could naturalize, you could become a citizen. That was not a right that everybody just had access to. And so one can understand the wariness that like, oh, this is going to be taken away. This is going to make us less safe. I think it's also important to note that in American Jewish institutions and philanthropic organizations, there's long been this sort of, I don't mean that these organizations today are full of elitists, but I do think that there's sort of an elitist strain since their founding of like, we know better than the Jewish people writ large. So for example, the American Jewish Committee was originally founded by these wealthier, more established Jews. And the idea was like, we know better than the Jewish masses what is going to keep the Jewish people in the United States safe and secure. You know, when did it change over? It's just, it was a numbers game. There were more American Jews from Eastern Europe than there were, like more American Jews came over in the late 19th and early 20th centuries than did prior to that. And also, over the course of the 20th century, they assimilated and acculturated. And so while there would have been a great difference between the great-grandfather, you know, I have friends whose family members came over earlier and who were, their ancestors were German Jews. Mine were not. There would have been a tremendous difference between my great-grandparents and theirs. There's not so much between us today because the 20th century took its course.
Right. And in terms of assimilation, you know, you talk about how the German origin Jews were really keen on in trying to ensure that these newcomers from Eastern Europe assimilated into some kind of culture that was perhaps acceptable to sort of the dominant WASP order in America at the time. And then there are some parallels to today where, or in recent decades, where this kind of Ashkenazic American Jewish culture has taken on a dominant form in terms of American Jewish culture. And then you have these others, other communities who are coming in or who have been coming in, Iranian Jews and Syrian Jews who actually have been coming here since the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, there are some expectations that they assimilate into these Ashkenazic American Jewish culture. And so within these subcultures is kind of like a pyramid that's going on. And so the immigrants who had come from Eastern Germany were at one point outcasts, but fast forward decades later, they assume a dominant role in the community because of numbers and also because of economic ascendance.
And I also think it's important to note that, like, for example, the Syrian Jewish community that you described has been very intentional at sort of, let's say, preserving some insularity. So for example, passing an edict in the early 20th century saying you have to marry another Jewish person and converts don't count. So you can't marry somebody who's converting to Judaism and say, okay, this is my new wife or husband. Like, and they did this because they wanted to sort of keep it within the broader family, so to speak. And I actually don't think that Syrian Jews or Persian Jews are like trying to become more like Ashkenazi Jews. And I wouldn't say that like that it's so much that Ashkenazi Jews are consciously putting pressure on these different communities to be more like them. But I do think it's true that there's this idea of, well, this is the American Jewish story, right? Like there's an idea of what an American Jew looks like. There's an idea of where an American Jewish family is from. There's probably an idea about their political leanings. And that's simply like not true for a portion of the population.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, when we talk about assimilation in a broader context, we tend to just talk about this kind of linear process where groups come in and they assume sort of the characteristics of the dominant WASP culture. But assimilation can also mean assimilating into another subculture.
Is that?
In one's midst, whether there's some kind of ethnic affinity or religious affinity. And so the dynamism and diversity of this country allows for that. In fact, that's a common theme that we see over the decades. Now, you touched upon this earlier, and I want to expand on this, this question of whiteness. And, you know, for some strange reason, it's reappeared these days, that this question of whether Jews are white. And, you know, this is a topic that reflects, in my view, the kind of polarization of our present moment when people can only think in these simple binaries and complex truths are simplified in these 280 character tweets, when in fact it's better to address them in longer form, whether it's books, essays, or extended conversations. So talk to us about why this question of are Jews white is actually quite complicated. It depends on who you ask and when, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I had some people say or criticize the book for how much I talk about race and racism in it and said, why is there so much of this in here? And my answer was that I was writing a book about American history. And you cannot write a book about American history, regardless of which specific population you're writing about, and not talk about race, because it's just so much part of the history of this country. So that's one thing. The second thing is that race, like racism is very real, and the impact of racism are very real, but race itself is a construct, and it's constructed differently in different places and at different periods of time. So for example, you know, you may remember a couple of years ago now, I think, Whoopi Goldberg on The View got in hot water by saying basically that the Holocaust wasn't about race, I think in her head it was like, well, Germans are white and Jews are white, so like this wasn't race-based. But in Europe, race was constructed differently and thought of differently, such that like the Nazis thought of Germanic people as one race, Slavic people as a different race, Jews as a different race. That doesn't necessarily make sense in the American context, where we've thought of race and had different racial hierarchies, but that doesn't mean that that wasn't also a construct through which people at some point in global history thought about racism, right? So here in the United States, I actually think this is really important because, like, you know, in the early 20th century, Jews thought of themselves, again, as ethnically distinct. They didn't think of themselves coming over as like, now we're white Americans. Why would they? That was not the construct that they had in, you know, in what's today Ukraine or Lithuania or Poland. But that was the construct that they had to fit into here. And that those who had arrived earlier were saying, no, you actually want to fit into this construct because this construct is what is going to protect you, right? Like, that's why I think it's really important to note that whatever most Jews may have been at different points, you know, it almost like, okay, I went back and looked up my great-grandparents' census records, and I can tell you that they were recorded as white. That doesn't mean that they weren't facing horrible discrimination in Eastern Europe. That doesn't mean that they weren't thought of as racially distinct in Eastern Europe. It means that they came here and were able to become citizens because the law considered them to be white. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that horrible things haven't befallen American Jewish people. I'm not saying that they weren't thought of as not white at their point of origin. I'm saying that here, under the law, they fit into a certain part on the a certain place on the racial hierarchy. Legally, it was more challenged socially and culturally. We should also say that today that's changing because the face of American Jewishness is changing, and there are more Black Jews and Asian American Jews and Hispanic Jews, Latin American Jews, et cetera, and so on and so forth. And I think what I also think is really important is that we know that Jews of color have said, hey, I feel discriminated against in white Jewish spaces. And I think it's really unacceptable. I'm saying this as a Jew who goes through life as a white person. I think it's really unacceptable to say like, no, you're not, or, well, that can't possibly happen to me because I don't even think of myself as white, right? Like that doesn't change the fact that when I go about my day, I'm treated like a white person. And when I'm in a synagogue, I'm in a mostly white space. Oh, and one more thing, which is that there are certain American Jewish intellectuals in the 20th century, today we would refer to them as the neoconservatives, who very consciously contrast themselves to Black Americans. And they do this, I mean, and we know why they do this, right? They do this in order to sort of distance themselves from Black Americans, to culturally put themselves in the same league or place as other white Americans, to establish themselves as part of the intellectual elite. And so I think it's, I have a real problem with people who say, oh, Jews aren't white, when we know from American history that most of us have benefited from the legal racial hierarchies of this country in ways both conscious and not. The last thing I will say on this is that most American Jews are white does not mean that most Israeli Jews are white. Or I think there's this line that's going around today that's, well, the problem is that most people think that Israelis are white and they're not. And like, if only people understood this. And I think it's true that Israeli Jews are a different racial makeup than here in the United States. It's true that it's different context, that race works differently. All of that is true. But I also don't think, I think that treating that as why Americans are critical of Israel is a bit of a cop-out, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like on Twitter, especially, there should be like some kind of button you can press to make the person delete their tweet and just read a book, you know, because in the end, you know, things are complicated, and the composition of the American Jewish community has changed over the centuries. Since the 1960s, there's been high rates of intermarriage, and then since the 1960s, the racial composition of America has changed due to immigration, and so that is producing, just to put it in sort of crass terms, different types of Jews, right? Mm-hmm. And so oh, you know, you can talk about the 1920s, but it's not the 1920s, it's the 2020s now.
Right.
And so you might have someone who's a Jewish in a religious sense and maybe through lineage, but has an Asian American parent. And so they're part of multiple worlds and
sure.
part of that is Jewish. And so imposing this simple binary of whiteness and non-whiteness is, it's like a modern appropriation of kind of the race science of old. And it's very strange in my view.
Yeah. And the problem is you're putting like, it depends on what context you're speaking in, of course, but it's like you're just putting something into a context that it wasn't made for, really, right? So like I would actually, Rabbi Angela Buchdahl in New York City is Asian American and Jewish and speaks about it really beautifully in that she talks about Jewishness as sort of being a family. And there's all sorts of different ways that people can come into a family, right? Some are born into it, some marry into it, some are adopted into it. Like there's cousins, there's distant relatives. I also really like to say that expanding on this, there are members of your family that you don't necessarily like or agree with or like want to see at a Seder. But I to me, that's a really helpful way of thinking of the composition of Jews and Jewishness and Judaism and the different ways that people relate to it and find their way into it.
Yeah. And then there are some like, you know, the Syrian Jews you had mentioned who have a very tighter definition of what it is to be part of their community and police that in a very strict way. And so it really depends. And I think that is something you'll find in many other groups. Now, one other thing you noted in your book is that this concept of whiteness, being white, had distinct value especially in the early 20th century, because it was a marker of full enfranchisement, or was a standard for full enfranchisement, and also the right to immigrate to the U.S. And so even at the same time, in the same time period, you had Arab immigrants to the U.S. who were also claiming that they were white because they wanted to stay here.
Mm-hmm.
And Elizabeth Thompson, as a scholar, she has a book out on the Syrian Arab Congress of 1920. And these were, I guess you can call them liberal advocates for an independent Syrian state. After the fall of the Ottoman Empire, they were led by Amir Faisal, and they were advocating before the League of Nations for an independent Syrian state. And to do that, they had to claim whiteness because that was indication that they were capable of self-rule. So Wilson had, issued this call for self-determination for all peoples, but in practice, it was really contingent upon whiteness. And so then you had mandates for the coloreds, you know, and so. So, it's important that when we look at this concept of whiteness, we look at it both at how it was constructed in sort of ideological sense and a social sense back then, but also what were the material benefits of that as well. And for people who, you know, migrated over, you know, a harrowing ship journey over months, and, you know, if you died on one of those ships, they just threw you over in the sea.
Mm-hmm.
That's one account. That's one thing that I'm constantly reminded of reading of that time period. So, you know, you're going to do what it takes to stay in this country. And if you check off on a box and say you're white, you know, that's part of the bargain, right? Now, I want to get to another fraught discussion, which is this question of Jews and money and wealth. And it's one that is fraught historically. It's laden with tropes that have often been quite deadly in many parts of the world, mm-hmm. including in Europe. But your book does a great job of challenging those tropes, both in terms of, you know, what we might call the good stereotypes and the bad. And so, you know, these days we still have these conspiracy theories about, and you'd mentioned the book that just came out, these supposed cabals of Jewish bankers controlling world finance. And then there's also this kind of counter image of Jews always having supported the persecuted because they themselves have been historically persecuted. Mm-hmm. But your account of the late 19th and early 20th century really challenges, I think, both stereotypes. So, for example, in this period, we have wealthier Jews who employed poor Jews in the garment sector, and they worked in terrible conditions. And that led to the rise of progressive Jewish activism, like the Bund in America, mm-hmm. and then newspaper outlets like the Ford. So I'd like you to talk about this moment, because in my view, it really upends a lot of the prevalent tropes about Jews, money, and class, And it's also a pivotal transformational, it's a pivotal and transformational moment historically in terms of American Jews as a political entity.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that I think a reader of this book can sort of sense some of my discomfort in writing about this because I am so aware of these stereotypes and how, and the pernicious, you know, their pernicious ends. But at the same time, I think that not writing about it, first of all, would be ahistorical. And second of all, like what an anti-Semite thinks and does actually has nothing to do with what I say and do, right? Like it's not actually about reality. It's about a hateful conspiracy. So, and I think it's actually quite, it's quite misguided to think that like, oh, if I just say the right things about Jews, then like everyone will, like anti-Semitism will go away. That's not how it works. And I also think, so that there's a chapter in the book called Laboring Jews, in which I look at, you know, the finance industry and capitalism and at philanthropy, but also at Jewish poverty, like when, you know, which is something like a fifth of Jews in this country today live below the poverty line, and at Jews in the labor movement, as you, which is a huge part of American Jewish history. So to go back to the period that you were talking about, right, you both have these very wealthy individuals who are not only shaping the systems of American finance as we know them, but also setting up, you know, philanthropic institutions that will help other Jews. And it is true that American Jews did slightly better than others during the Great Depression, in part because of these networks, because, you know, they helped each other find jobs and they helped each other, you know, with sort of financial support and so on. But I think it, you know, in the same time period, you also have Jews working in, as you said, like quite unfortunate conditions and being, you know, central to the labor movement and central to the movement for workers' rights. And also at the same time, you have Jews using the little bit of wealth that they do have in some cases to distinguish themselves from Black Americans. So, you know, there's a moment in the book, and I got this from a book called The Price of Whiteness, where basically you had pretty poor Jewish women still going to like barter for very little money over which Black woman would be their helper, right? Because that's, it's American capitalism, right? Like you could find somebody to put down a little bit lower than you. And I just think it's important to note the ways in which Jews like bucked the trends of American assimilation and sought to make life better for their fellow Americans and their fellow Jews, and also the ways in which they didn't do that, because no group of people is all good or all bad. And even, you know, a given individual may have done things that were both really positive and negative in their one lifetime. I think that this is sort of related to another thing, which is Jews' sort of political leanings, really from their involvement in, really from FDR on, Jews have been something like 60 to 70% of Jews in every election vote Democratic. The New Deal was called the Jew Deal because of how many Jews FDR had working on it. But we should also say that you know, this trend of, there was sort of like a leftist, socialist, pro-labor trend in Jewish communities, and that part sort of dissolves for a few reasons. One is that many Jews are now living in the suburbs. They've gotten more money. They've acculturated. They don't, you know, like what factory are they organizing? They're not working in the factories anymore. The other is that during the Red Scare, American Jewish groups, mainstream American Jewish groups, kind of side with the government. Right. They, the AJC, which I mentioned earlier, and the Anti-Defamation League kick communists and communist sympathizers out of their groups. The AJC goes as far as to sort of turn its roles over to the FBI. And they do this both, you know, the sort of normal way we think about this is, oh, they were scared because this is on the heels of World War II. You know, it was the Red Scare, it was McCarthyism. They were scared. Like, that's genuine. But it's also true that they did not want Jews to be associated with communists and communism, and sort of took this moment to try to ensure that they weren't going forward. And I think that's an important, you know, I think we often think of that moment in American Jewish history as one of victimization, and it was, but it was also one of the sort of tension within Jewish communities.
Yeah. There's often this trope of, you know, Jews stick together and there's this exploitation of outsiders and all that. And I think this period upends those bigoted tropes, because what we see is that, one, there are class distinctions and exploitation within the community. And then amid the Red Scare, we have sort of these heads of these establishment organizations within the Jewish community turn on those who are maybe part of the far left or were seen to be as part of the far left. And so, you know, oftentimes people essentialize Jews in general and American Jews in particular. And if you ask, you know, how did Jews respond to X? Well, there are many different responses, mm-hmm. right? Some did this, some did that. And that is not, you can point to any sort of a demographic and there are multiple responses to various social moments. And so, you know, you talk about in your book, you address some things that may be seen as negative and maybe an anti-Semite can kind of pick out those and cherry pick them and then make some crazy Twitter thread about, you know, all the terrible things Jews did in the 19th century or something. But you can do that with any group. It's difficult to control how the information or ideas we put out there, it's difficult to control how they're used, but many people can kind of use them in a very disingenuous way.
Yeah. I mean, I had someone say to me, like, why didn't you write a book about good Jews? And I was like, well, there are a lot of people who did things that I consider to be really good in this book, too. But I actually don't think that it's like, I actually think that to pretend that a group is all good and has been good at every moment in its history is incredibly dehumanizing, because that's not like nobody is like that anywhere. And I will also say that, you know, this book, I think, really embraces the idea of pluralism and of the idea that there are just as reality, right? Like just that is how they're as fact. And I had someone say to me, like, but how then can we band together to fight anti-Semitism? And I said to this person, when in American Jewish history has that actually happened, right? Like Jews did not really know how to respond to the immigration crackdown. There were differences of opinion about, okay, well, what do we do? Like, should we speak out? Should we try to rally against this? Should we, like, how do we, there were differences of opinion about how to respond to the Holocaust and how prominent Jews and Jewish voices should be in the fight to protect European Jews and later Jewish refugees. In the Red Scare, right? There's Roy Cohn prosecuting Ethel Rosenberg. Like, what mystical period of time are you talking about where Jews have all come together to stand up against the forces against Jews in this country? Now, there's one moment I think people often point to of Jewish solidarity in this country, which is to help Jews from Soviet Union get out, right? to help refuseniks get out and come to the United States or to get to Israel and to be allowed to leave the Soviet Union. And I think that's a really interesting example because it's a moment of American Jews banding together, but not for American Jews, right? It's for Jews elsewhere, which is sort of less relevant, but I think worth pointing out.
Yeah, and it's always a challenge to, as a minority, to write about one's own community for a general audience, because there's always that burden of, am I representing the community? And could this result in harm to the broader community? But I think what I really liked about your book is it demystifies Jews or American Jews, because we have this really strange way in which, especially a lot of, I would say, like, Christian Zionists speak about Jews. They may not know many Jews in real life, and they may actually disdain actual Jews, who live on,
right.
Who are, regarded as coastal cultural elites and the, supposed culture that they've shaped in this country through the media and all that. And then they're also pivotal figures in this end times narrative. And so in the end, what your book shows is that, they're all different types of people who are part of this community, who happen to be part of this community. And so they make choices, and they make choices as human beings, peoples who are part of different collectives, their class interests, their political interests. And, they're not moving. There's not, some cabal that's kind of moving in lockstep. It's very discordant.
Yeah. And this is really important. There's no Jewish Pope, right? Like,
yeah,
there isn't,
exactly.
And there's not even in the United States, there's no Jewish Board of Deputies like there is in the UK. There's no one chief rabbi for American Jews. There are individuals who individual Jewish communities think of as very important, but like there's no one person that we're all reporting back to. And in fact, early efforts to have there be such a person failed miserably, right? Like this American Jews have always been pluralistic. There has never been one set American Jewish community, really, you know, not for centuries. It has always been American Jewish communities, which overlap and intersect, but also contradict each other. And I think, I don't think that we as Jewish people should be afraid of that. I just think that's reality.
Yeah. And it's a reality for all peoples. And I wish, you know, we'd have a public discourse that allows for discussion of all peoples like that. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you mentioned this transition towards the suburbanization of the American Jewish community. And I want to talk about how that transition from this, the 1920s, where one might have seen perhaps like a high point of this progressive Jewish activism, labor Jewish activism, with the Bund, with the Forward, and the Yiddish language, and played a big role. There was a robust Yiddish culture with theaters and newspapers. The Forward, for example, was one of the most circulated newspapers in America at the time. And then after the Second World War, there's this rapid suburbanization and the emergence of this kind of democratic centrism. And that secular left, Yiddish culture, the Bund, they all kind of disappear. So I'd like you to talk about that transition.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the move out to suburbia. It's the you know, you're not going down the street and going to and picking up your Yiddish language paper and going to the kosher butcher down the street. The institution that does move out to to American Jews, the institution that does move out to suburbia with American Jews is the synagogues, and which are built at great speed and a great scale across the land, because it's this period of like, okay, we're going to go back to being white people who pray differently for many American Jews. But I should say that this is also, you know, shortly after this happens, we get the civil rights movement, which American Jews, not all but many, are very involved in. And again, and I do think that this comes back to like this feeling enough, you know, I don't think it's accidental that you have more American Jews in the North and in the South who are vocal about supporting the movement, at least, right? It comes from this position of security and stability that allows you to speak out for, like, and this is not to say that there isn't a genuine feeling of empathy for this other persecuted people and for another people that's been oppressed. But it's also true that Southern Jews are more ambivalent about vocally supporting the civil rights movement than their Northern counterparts, because they're the ones whose stores are going to be boycotted. Right, they're the ones whose children are going to have to, but I think it's important to note that it's not like Jewish activism stops in the early 20s. So in the 60s, and we should also not romanticize the 60s, right? Like, we know that there were also Black Americans who felt that Jews were being very paternal, that some Jews were being very paternalistic in how they approached civil rights, and we know that American Jews were ambivalent about, especially American Jewish men, were ambivalent about affirmative action, because what if it reinstated quotas? And, you know, they didn't like quotas because of how they were kept out of universities in the early 20th century, and so on and so forth. But we should also say, you know, there's a book I really recommend to your listeners, which is Mark Dolinger's Black Power, Jewish Politics. And basically, it explores how, you know, often people sort of look at, okay, in the 60s, these two groups worked together, and in the 70s, it all came apart. And he makes the case that actually, well, first of all, we should note that, like, even back in the 60s and 70s, there were Black Jews. And I don't mean to sort of erase those people from this conversation. But the majority of Jews at the time were white. The majority of Black Americans at the time were not Jewish. And Mark Dolinger basically makes the case that because Jews had reached a certain period of assimilation and security, they look to the Black Power movement and to Black American activism, and sort of incorporate its distinctiveness and sort of, let's say, identity-focused approach to civil rights, and incorporate that for themselves. This is a horrible example, but you have the Jewish Defense League, which is like, which is basically a Jewish, not basically, it was a Jewish supremacist group. You have, but even, you know, you could say that some of the really staunch pro-Israel advocacy that we see come out of this period is coming out more generally of this period of nationalistic, almost, advocacy.
Yeah. And what's interesting in this period is, you know, as incomes rise in the community, we don't see that transition towards conservatism in a political sense at sort of a broad level. And the writer Milton Himmelfarb, he wrote this, several decades ago. He said, Jews earn like Episcopalians and vote like Puerto Ricans.
And I have to say, I've always hated this quote. This quote has always made me so angry because, first of all, like it's just so disparaging toward like everybody in that sentence, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But the other part of it is like, Milton, we're a minority in this country. Like, I always find it so funny when people think the Jews are somehow voting against their interests by voting for the party that is, of the two, more devoted toward pluralism. Like, in the 1950s, and you have American Jews saying, hey, could we please not have Christian prayer in schools? We're Jewish. And their neighbors like writing into the school, into the local paper, decrying them. Like, why would any person, I mean, I understand why people do, but like personally, I would not vote for the person who was like, yeah, I think more of that is good, right? I think it's directly within many Jews' interests to continue to vote for a party that's going to protect civil rights, as those rights have also kept Jews safe in this country. So yeah. I just find this sort of like, huh, like if Jews make money, why are they voting for Democrats? I just find it so like, it's to say that is to reduce Jews to their socioeconomic status, which is so funny to me because the people saying it are often themselves conservative Jews. So it's like, sure, if you assume that the only thing that matters to Jews is like not paying taxes, then sure, but that's not true. So thus they're not voting for Republicans en masse.
Yeah, yeah. And his statement kind of reflects sort of the crass way people would speak about ethnic groups in the 1950s and 60s, mm-hmm. especially in sort of the outer boroughs of New York. But in the 1950s and 1960s, we did see the emergence of this kind of what is called neoconservatism mm-hmm. among a small subset, but a very impactful subset of the community. And so some of the most prominent neoconservatives then and today have been American Jewish intellectuals. And today, the term is almost exclusively used in a foreign policy sense, but that back then, it was as much about domestic policy as it was about foreign policy. And so American Jews on the whole were really supportive of the New Deal and the Great Society, but these neoconservatives were folks, some of them whom were ex-Trotskyites who graduated from schools like CUNY in New York, and then they became cold warriors and opposed LBJ's Great Society. And Irving Kristol, who's one of the leading neoconservatives, passed away some years ago. He said neoconservatives are a neoconservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality. So the reason I bring them up is because I find some parallels between the emergence of neoconservatism then and this kind of counter progressivism we see today from folks like. Maybe Barry Weiss, some of the writers of Tablet magazine, and kind of small but impactful American Jewish public intellectual demographic. And there's a lot of continuity too. You know, a lot of the writers for commentary, mm-hmm. the original writers, their kids still write for the publication. But it seems to me like this moment where we do have, you know, some American public intellectuals who happen to be Jewish and maybe write as Jews. It seems to me that there are some parallels between the kind of reaction to the progressivism or the liberalism of then and today. Do you see those parallels as well? Do you agree?
I absolutely see a parallel. And here's the parallel that I really want to stress, which is that the neoconservatives back then, as you mentioned, had this line, which was basically like, I didn't leave the left left me. And that's true in one sense. But if you go back and read their early writings, they're how to put this? I would describe many of them as very racist, right? Like the way in which some of these men wrote about Black Americans, I find like even at the time was not like a forward-thinking, progressive, I would argue was not a liberal way of approaching American society. And so to say then like, well, the civil rights movement has gone too far and that's why I'm going to now turn back toward conservatism. It's like, you were never on board with that. You know, you were never really advancing the civil rights movement. And I guess I find this interest, this is what I find the parallel to be today, is the people who are like, I was on board with progressivism and DEI and racial equity until now. And it's like, but I've went back and read your writings and you weren't. You know what I mean? Like that was never what you were about. And so I think then and now there's a certain sort of mode of writing that's like, I'm a liberal, but, and the what comes after the but is just like pretty classic reactionary. And that's okay, but we should, like, it's what it is, but we should just recognize that it's not like this is coming from somebody who is a great proponent of civil rights or progressivism or liberalism or what have you in the first place.
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, to some extent whether, you know, those, the contemporary voices are kind of just imitating what we've, you know, what we saw in the 50s and the 60s. And so it could just be kind of like a reenactment of something because it's kind of an established thing. So you, then you
yeah,
get to
and
write
also,
the commentary.
Look, like, yeah, I mean, commentary had outsized influence. Like, given that people were not actually following commentary's advice on how to vote, commentary had outsized influence on American Jewish political and intellectual life, right? Like they were very influential writers and thinkers. But I also think that we shouldn't overstate their influence or say that like, or pull out, you know, a commentary piece and say like, well, this was how American Jews were thinking in the 1960s, because it wasn't.
Right.
But it was sort of articulating how they thought American Jews should be thinking in the 1960s, right? It was like, well, why we should just consider, we should just care only about or primarily about Jewish issues as defined by me, the writer of this commentary article. I should say, commentary did not like this or should not run a positive review of this book, but I actually didn't read it. So that's not what's inspiring this this sentiment, which I think is in keeping with the chapter on these figures as published in Bad Jews.
Yeah. Now, another, you know, continuing with this kind of thread of this these counter forces against what one might call the kind of dominant liberal tradition within contemporary American Jewish politics, there's also what one might call an opposition to assimilation or even a push for what one can call de-assimilation. So you spoke with one writer for Tablet, Vladislav Davidson, and he had some very strong things to say about American Jews. He said, I don't like American Jews. I don't really want to be one. I find a lot of them to be weak, conformist, and really deeply boring. So I want you to talk about his perspective, because I think that is kind of like a reoccurring portrayal that I see from a lot of people in Israel, and then also from some Jews on the right elsewhere, including in the U.S.
Yeah.
And there is this portrayal of the American Jew as too comfortable and meek.
I think there's two different things going on here. First, I think there has since the mid-20th century, there's been, I think, American Jewish men. I want to be careful how I say this. Since the mid-20th century, I think American Jewish men have had like have sort of portrayed themselves as weak in comparison to Israeli Jewish men, have found their identity in the idea of like the comfortable nebbish or the like the comfortable commercially affluent intellectual, as opposed to both their forefathers and their Israeli counterparts. I don't actually think this is like true, but I do think that this is, in the same way that I don't think it's true that all American Jewish women are like, you know, materialist housewives, who are like selfish and self-centered. Although that is the vision, that's sort of the narrative that comes out in the mid-20th century about American Jewish women in comparison to American Jewish men, and also in comparison to Israeli Jewish women, right? So I think there are these narratives that people have found weirdly like comforting in some way because it helped ground their sense of self, but also they chafed against. The other thing that I think this brings up is that there is, in my opinion, a deeply nostalgic streak in American Jewish history. So, you know, in the 1920s, you have people looking at Europe and saying like, oh, that's where, you know, that's where we worshiped properly. That's where we knew how to be like really religious. You move out to the suburbs and you say, oh, well, it was on the Lower East Side that we were like more authentically Jewish because we lived in these Yiddish speaking neighborhoods and there was poverty and there was like, and all of this is sort of like a romanticization of struggle and poverty and as though that's what it meant to be Jewish. But anyway, you know, there's this, oh, that was, you know, we were really Jewish back in the Lower East Side. And then I think even today you have people look and say like, oh, the 20th century, you know, American Jews sort of knew who they were and they were fighting intermarriage and they all supported Israel. And now everybody's intermarried and like, and all these children are more critical of Israel and it's all coming apart. So I just think that there's been this, like, I can't really think of a period in the last at least the last century, where American Jews have been like, wow, we're in a great spot. You know what I mean? Like, we're authentic. We know what it is to be Jewish. We're proud. Like, it's always, there's always been the strain of looking elsewhere and backward and saying, like, that's what it's really meant to be about.
Yeah. And I think in your book, you talk a lot about, you address some of the guilt that many experienced after World War II.
Absolutely.
And then, you know, that, you know, we didn't have to go through what others had to in Europe, you know, with the Holocaust. And so, you know, the American suburban experience is almost too perfect. It's life is about comfort. And mm-hmm. then that heightens the contrast when you have, you know, people who have come from camps and have tattoos on them and
right.
and suffered through horrific things and coming into your neighborhoods and coming home, whether they're relatives or people who are part of your broader community. And I think that the contrast becomes very stark, and then people have to figure out. Yeah,
I also think there was a contrast with, like, well, look at these people moving out to Israel, and aren't they brave? And they're really doing something for the Jewish people. And what are we doing? We're just here in our homes writing a check, right? I think there's this sort of self-criticism as well.
Yeah, yeah. And it brings to mind Chaim Weizmann, who's the first president of Israel. I think he was head of the Jewish agency then in the 1930s. And there are these letters that he wrote. I forgot to who it was, but it's a series of letters in the late 1930s. And he really rails against the then publisher of the New York Times, Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, who happened to be Jewish. And he was also a vocal opponent of Zionism then. And he calls him a cowardly assimilated Jew. So it's almost a slur. So here in the U.S., mm-hmm. there is this pressure to assimilate and not really stand out. And let's say you live in a suburb. Now maybe you're accepted into the golf club, local golf club, mm-hmm. or the country club. And, you know, you want to sort of show that you're not too different. And then there's these pejoratives that are thrown to you from, you know, across the ocean, that you're too comfortable, you're cowardly, mm-hmm. you're assimilated. But, you know, you're not going to walk around with an Uzi in the middle of the suburbs of Long Island, because it's safe. And, mm-hmm. you know, it points towards, in the sum, America's a pretty good country. And there is this, for many groups, there is this path toward security in an economic sense, in a social sense, and it definitely has its warts. And then I think people have to kind of contend with the burden of that comfort, and they nostalgize, you know, the old right. world or the old neighborhood. But when you're in the old world and you're in the old neighborhood, you want to get out.
Right. So I don't think it's an accident that Fiddler on the Roof comes out as a musical in the 60s and then comes out as a movie in the 70s, right? Like,
yeah.
it's only once American Jews are comfortable, at least physically, like, and not everyone, right? But the majority are more comfortable and safe and secure, that they can start looking back and romanticizing, right? And exploring. And I think there's this sense of, like, I think the question at the heart of this book is, what is it to be an American Jew, right? Like, can you be, okay, you know, if you're an American Jew in the suburbs, what does that mean? Does it mean you go to synagogue? Does it mean that you remember the Holocaust? Does it mean that you eat your mom's cooking that was a family recipe? Does it mean that you support, that you have a certain position on Israel? Does it mean you vote a certain way? Like, and if you take away any one of those things, are you still Jewish? Like, is this still a secure enough thing that it can be pushed a little
bit? Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the comforts of the suburbs also come along with it. Along with it comes this alienation. You know, you're mm-hmm. in a 2,000 square foot home and you can't hear anyone around you. You're not in, a tightly packed set of row houses or a tenement or apartments, and you can't hear the neighbor's baby crying. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people lose that sense of community, and then they have to reimagine it in some sense. And it's maybe reformed in the sense of driving to a temple and attending and worship and community events and things like that. So, you know, I want to bring this discussion to what might be called the contemporary crisis of American mm-hmm. Zionism. In your book, you interview a young woman named Hannah Kahn, and she taught Hebrew school for a couple of years. And she says, and she told you she finds the elements of the curriculum on Israel to be questionable. And this is something I've heard as well when I speak to Jewish friends. When they kind of first encounter an informed critical perspective on Israel, there's often this a kind of shock because it upends what they learned in Hebrew school. And for those who are unaware, you know, Hebrew school is basically like a Jewish Sunday school that takes place on Saturday. Kids learn the Hebrew alphabet, Jewish history, religious basics, and then I think since the Six-Day War, there's been some elements about Israel as well. And I think this is not unique to Jews. There are a lot of different groups that when they sort of step out of their community's bounds, they learn things about their own community and have to kind of confront that. But there is this process of confronting some of the negative aspects of Israel and things that don't conform to this kind of standard narrative that is often, you know, inculcated through Hebrew schools and maybe through Birthright and things like that. So talk to us more about, you know, some of the people you've spoken with who had to come to terms with sort of this new understanding of Israel and the impact on them and how it's leading to maybe a new understanding of what it means to be Jewish, perhaps with Israel playing less of a central role.
Yeah, I spoke to many younger people for this book, by younger, let's say under 40, and I would ask them, like, is there something from your own upbringing that either you really appreciated or that you wish had been different? And one of the more common answers was, I just wish that I had been educated differently about Israel. Because over and over again, you hear, like, they go to college and their world is kind of rocked because they're taught to believe the, you know, sort of one version of the country, and it cannot square with not only what their peers are saying, but what they're seeing on the news. And I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's accidental that we know from the Jewish Electorate Institute, a poll that came out after October 7th, it was something like 80% of American Jews writ large supported Biden's policy toward Israel's war on Hamas and in Gaza. But if you go to 35 and under, that number drops to half, right? Like, we know that younger American Jews, millennials and under, are much more, you know, much more critical of Israel, much less likely to say that caring about Israel is a huge part of their identity. And I think there are a few things going on here. One is that actually roughly half of American Jews haven't actually been to Israel. And so it's really important to the Jewish American imagination and American Jewish sense of self. But it's not that every American Jew has a very close and established relationship to the country, and ideas can get changed, right? Ideas can have pressure put upon them. And the other thing is, like, if you are in your 30s, you've really only seen the situation between Israelis and Palestinians get worse, you know, and you have also been brought up with these, for the most part, liberal, like vaguely liberal, vaguely progressive values, and are told to apply these in all areas of your life. It's not reasonable for people to then say, oh, but just not this one area, right? Not this one area that, oh, by the way, we've told you is core to your identity. And so I think you're seeing two things. One, and okay, well, first I want to say this is not true of everyone. This is not true for the traditionally Orthodox, which is about 10% of the American Jewish population. And it's also less true for communities that have a sort of later immigration story. So it's not true, for example, for many former Soviet Jews, and it's not true for many Persian Jews who tend to be more supportive of Israel, perhaps because they have more family there, and two, because it's closer to their own moment of, like, there's a young Persian Jew who I interview in the book who said that her dad taught her, without Israel, we'd all be dead. Like, that's what's most important. The moment of departure is closer in the family's history, or the family's memory, let's put it that way. But I think generally what you are seeing is either you're seeing young American Jews just check out, right? Like, whatever Judaism is for them, whatever Jewishness is for them, it's not about Israel. Or alternatively, some of the people I know, the younger American Jews I know, who are most like into being Jewish, like obsessed with it, right? They're critical of Israel. They're out there. They're the ones out there doing the ceasefire protests because this is their application of Jewish values as they understand it. So I think American Jewishness is in this moment of very real, in some cases, very painful conflict. But as I learned in writing the book, and I'm not trying to downplay the moment that we're in, I think the horrific attacks on October 7th, like, really shocked and scarred a lot of people here. I think that the ensuing debates within American Jewish communities have been, again, deeply painful for many people. I'm not trying to downplay any of that. What I am saying is that if one looks at American Jewish history, yes, we are at a moment of conflict and crisis, but I think in some ways, we have just been in a series of moments of conflict. I don't know that part, that there is profound disagreement between American Jews right now. I don't actually know that that's, I think that part's not new.
Yeah, it's not unprecedented because I think you know this in your book, you know, during the Vietnam War, that that was another moment in which I guess you can call it leftist or progressive anti-war activism was at height. And that translated also into criticism of Israel among young American Jewish activists on college campuses. And so Irving Howe, who's the author of what one might call the definitive book on the Jewish Lower East Side, The World of Our Fathers, in 1970, he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, and he writes, "Jewish boys and girls, children of the generation that saw Auschwitz, hate democratic Israel and celebrate as quote-unquote revolutionary the Egyptian dictatorship. Some of them pretend to be indifferent to the anti-Jewish insinuations of the Black Panthers. A few go so far as to collect money for al-Fatah, which pledges to take Tel Aviv. About this, I cannot say more. It is simply painful." And so, you know, you can kind of replace some of the groups.
I mean, you could have that today, right? Like that. Exactly. That could have run today.
Yeah. And I think that there's an inherent tension between, you know, being anti-war and in favor of social justice, and then being pressed to support a state that, you know, violates those principles in many ways. And so we have agency here as Americans to shape our own process. But then when it gets to supporting another country, we're not voters there, right? And so this kind of virtual support is challenging, and also especially so when it's against our own core values. So, you know,
there's a real difference between growing up as a minority in a place and growing up as the majority in a place. And I think insofar as American Jews feel ourselves to be a minority, it's you want to protect minority, like you want to protect liberalism, right? You want to protect pluralism. It's like I was saying earlier about why Jews vote for Democrats. Like it's because you value all of these things. And I think I don't mean this in a judgmental way. I just mean it as a matter of fact. Like, historically and presently, ethno-nationalism and liberalism it's hard to square that circle.
It is. And I think when we look at, you know, the history of the West, when it comes to ethno-nationalism and a greater role for religion in the public sphere, it ends up being a bad bargain for Jews. So that's the case in Europe, and then, you know, less so in America, but that's why there's always been pushback here, because of, you know, the horrors of what was seen in Europe. And so, you know, what it seems to me is that there is a gap between, you know, the question of what's good for American Jews and what's good for Israel. Because, you know, we can have someone like Benjamin Netanyahu who courts the far right in Eastern Europe, but it's okay for Israel because Israel is a sovereign nation state, has a very strong military, and faces a new military threat from those states, which have largely eviscerated their Jewish populations. So, you know, these were once areas where Jews had inhabited for centuries. And then, you know, over the course of decades, and then during World War II, they were largely exterminated. And it was just, it was a campaign of ethnic cleansing that, in now, as a result, they don't have much of a Jewish minority to whose security, you know, maybe other Jews have to think about, because they've been pushed out or killed. And so
I also think that there are that many American Jews look at Israel in the context of everybody looks at Israel in the context of Jewish history, right? And there are many who look at attacks on Israel, both real and like both physical and rhetorical, and say, like, look at this. This is, you know, this goes into the history of Jewish persecution. And in some sense, like, okay, yes, it does exist within the context of Jewish history, but there are others who note, and I think this is correct, to say that there is a very real difference between, and actually Shaul Magid in his new book, The Necessity of Exile, sort of writes this very beautifully, like, there is a difference between an attack on a Jewish minority by the state, which is what we saw in Europe for much of Jewish history there. That is different from Jews who are not oppressed by the state, but are perhaps experiencing anti-Semitism at the social and cultural level, which is like, let's call that the North American variant. That is different from a state, from criticism of a Jewish state that has the power to oppress other people. And he uses the example of like a Palestinian throwing a rock at an Israeli soldier. Like, is that anti-Semitism? He argues no. And I do think that while all of this, yes, all of these exist within Jewish history, and all of these are, you know, are like it's a Jewish person in each one of those stories, I do think it's right and appropriate to say that there's a difference between speaking up against, speaking of Jews in situations where they're a minority and speaking for Jews in a situation where they are in charge of the state and the army and the government.
Right, right. Now, when we look at, you know, many American Jews who, younger American Jews who are on the left, do you feel that some of them may feel out of place because, you know, in the wake of October 7th, some voices on the left were pretty insensitive to the loss of innocent life in the Hamas attacks. And then at the same time, you have establishment groups like the ADL, which, you know, as you write in your book, some of its, I think its former employees believe that it's pulled punches on Trump and the far right, as long as they're good on Israel. And so, you know, we have elements of the establishment American Jewish organizations like the ADL and AIPAC courting some of these very scary figures in an American context. But then on the left, you know, there are some things that are said that are pretty stupid, I would say, regarding American Jews, but then other things that are, you know, somewhat malevolent. And so I'm wondering for, you know, some of the people you've spoken to who are on the left, do they feel maybe they're out of place?
Yeah, I think certainly on October 7th and in the immediate days and weeks that followed, I mean, we know there were like, I think I counted like 15 pieces on American Jews and the left, right? And I'm not trying to downplay this phenomenon at all. And I do know, like, I've spoken to progressive American Jews who felt quite saddened and out of place, as you say, from some of the rhetoric. But I also think that for progressive American Jews, at least the people to whom I have spoken, the alienation, the sense of alienation is greater with Jewish establishment groups or with sort of the Jewish community writ large. I think they see greater distance there, or like greater distance there, greater disappointment there in some ways, right? Than with their fellow progressive brethren.
Right. And final question, and this is really open-ended. In the coming years and decades, how do you think what it means to be an American Jew or a Jew in America, how do you think that will change?
I honestly don't know the answer to this question. I think that I think that in the short term, I think we're in for a period of painful reckoning, to be honest. I think that the response, particularly in the last 3 months, toward Jewish disagreement has been quite ugly, has been quite painful. I think the impulse to cast other Jews out has been really on full display. And I don't know what's on the other side of that. And I also don't know what domestic political challenges, let's say the next presidential election will bring for American Jews, in addition to a host of other people. But what I write in the book is that I think that change is a constant of the American Jewish experience. And what I hope American Jews will hang on to is, you know, I guess I hope that American Jews in the years to come will ask ourselves what it is about being Jewish that we want to hang on to. And I mean that both individually and collectively. I think Jewish debate and introspection will remain a constant. And actually, I think that's a good thing.
And that was Emily Tamkin. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice. And thank you for tuning in.